This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
Now, the longer I do comedy, the more I'm starting to see that I think jealousy is just a part of comedy. And Colin goes, "What's your last name?" I go, "Soder." He goes, "Ugh, change it." And then he walked away. Finishing your closing bit while half the room is leaving is one of the most humbling experiences anyone can go through. When you're like, "And then I said to him," because you have like that line locked up, you know,
right.
Like, I go over there and I look at him and I say, "That's not a parachute." And people are just walking out and like, "Thank you, everyone. Good night."
Hot breath. All right. Hot breath-averse. Welcome back to the Hot Breath Podcast. This is the show where you learn comedy from the pros. This is our live Q&A series. If you're watching this on YouTube or listening to the podcast later, go join our Facebook group. It's free. There's comics from around the world in there connecting and engaging and getting access to some of the top comedy minds in the world. And without any exception, our guest definitely ranks on that. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, hot brethren and sister, and welcome to the Hot Breath of Verse, Mr. Dan Soder. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Soder.
Hey, what's up? Hello, digital people. Hello, not being able to hear applause. It's creepy as hell.
There was a sound effect, if that makes you feel any better.
That makes me feel much better. I didn't hear it, so I didn't get the fake adulation.
So
I didn't get that the fake bump, the fake spike in adrenaline.
Oh, but you will get the hot breath bump. I will say, after Mark Norman did his first hot breath episode a few years ago, his career just took off. So I think this may be your big break, Dan.
I knew this was the fuel in Norman's tank. I fucking knew it. At first, I was like, is it because he writes such great jokes and he's a great comic? I'm like, nope, he's got that hot breath. He got that hot breath rub.
So what we can do, actually, because I was going to start with the quarantine situation and all this, but we were talking off air, we'll just jump into what we were talking about with the comedy show that we just saw happen in New York and your jealousy, I think you said. You're feeling very jealous.
Oh, yeah, dude, immediately jealous. I saw, I woke up, I think it was yesterday, and my girlfriend was on Instagram and she was like, "Oh, did you see they did that Michael Che did a comedy show?" And I was like, "Yeah, I heard he was going to do that." And then I saw pictures and immediately was like, man, it's so funny, like the insecurity of a comedian or just my insecurities. I can't speak for everyone. But immediately I was like, oh, I want to do stand up right now. And then number two, I was like, oh, man, I didn't get booked on that show. And Then you're immediately like, yeah, dude, Che's like, he did like a show in the back of a flatbed in Long Island City. And the lineup was awesome. It was Petey, Rosebud Baker, Nimesh. There was a lot of fun comics on that. And then Big J and Joe DeRosa went up with Che and like hung out and made and like, you know, talk shit. And that was also why I was jealous. I was like, man, that would be so fun just to be. Honestly, I don't know if I'm jealous for the stage time or if I'm jealous just to be around people making other people laugh.
Yeah.
I think that's something that I really fucking miss.
That's interesting, even hearing someone like 15 years in with you, you just released the HBO special, you've done so many awesome things, and yet you're still in this, you still have that impulse that I think every comic has, to where we're like, oh, I didn't get booked on that?
Yeah, dude,
there's a
that's
conspiracy.
Every list. Yeah, every list, every show, everything, I think, I'm interested to see, like, you know, I've heard before in comedy that like at 10 years, you kind of figure out what you're doing. At 15 years, you kind of hone it more. At 20, you get to that next level or whatever. And I was like, when is it where you don't care if you're not on a lineup that's good? Like, when is it, what year is it where you're like, they're like, coming up, it's the new lineup at Clusterfest, which I didn't even want to do. And I was like, man, they didn't ask me.
Exactly.
It doesn't even have to be a good thing. It can be a shitty thing where they're like, we're doing barnyard comedy just for horses. And you're like, man, why didn't they book me?
If it has a cool flyer, there's automatic jealousy, regardless of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I think now the longer I do comedy, the more I'm starting to see that I think jealousy is just a part of comedy. I think it's like not necessarily in just a negative way. I think, I don't know. I always get jealous when I see people with bits that I'm like, man, I wish I would have thought of that. I don't think that goes away. I hope it doesn't go away, or else I'm gonna be a sociopath, just not caring about jokes. But yeah, I think jealousy is a part of stand-up, and I think I would have liked to have known that earlier on.
Have you found any ways to at least kind of alleviate some jealousy over more minute things as opposed to like maybe a bigger thing?
No, I've noticed with jealousy, it's always jealousy or negativity is most of the time just something that you have a problem with yourself. Mm-hmm. So like when I'm jealous about that kind of stuff, I'm like, well, maybe I should go work harder. Maybe I should just shut up and go write more or go do more sets or try to have better sets. Or, you know, that's always the way I've been, where I've just kind of like anytime I've gotten. And by the way, it doesn't always come from like a very like, oh, I'm going to be better. Sometimes it comes straight up from a spiteful like, well, I'm going to go do sets. Let's see how you guys like me in 5 years when I say no, I won't be on that show. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, and then the next week they're like, hey, do you want to do my show? And you're like, oh, I would love to do the show.
You're like, yeah, I'll check my calendar, but we'll see. Pencil in.
I had a lot of that coming up in New York where like I wouldn't get put on the cool shows and I would be like, well, fuck you. Then I'm going to go do my own thing. And then they'd be like, do you want to do the show? And I'd be like, I would, that would be great. That would be absolutely lovely. And then you're like, yeah, it's funny, man. And I think, I'm excited to be around comedians again.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be around comedy again. I'm getting excited.
What kind of tips do you have for comics going through the current quarantine? Because a topic that's come up in our community has been like, oh, when do we get back on stage? I'm starting to like fiend for it or whatever. But it's like, what advice do you have for comics on like how they can maximize the time they have away from the stage to propel their career? So when the stage comes back, like they're hitting the ground running.
I don't know, man, because I've thought about it a lot. Even a conversation I had with my mom where she was like, if this would have happened to you 10 years ago, you'd have to move back to Denver. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would absolutely have to move back. I'm shit. If this happened in 2013 or 2014, I would have had to move back to Denver. So there's this real thing of I kind of feel for comics coming up right now because the fragility of it was just exposed, where it's just completely taken away. And there probably were a lot of comedians that were making progress, not only professionally, but personally in comedy. Like there's moments, and it's, you know, I remember when I was first starting and I would watch like Last Comic Standing or Tough Crowd and listen to Opie and Anthony. And I always remember the advice was always the same. It was like, get on stage as much as you can. Mm-hmm. And I always thought it was like, I thought that advice was kind of boring, but now I've said this before, but I mean it. I think it's the same as when someone is like, how do I lose weight? And they're like, diet and exercise. And you're like, no. Like, how do I really lose weight? And they're like, diet and exercise. It's just a commitment. And the thing about stand-up is I can't tell you when I've turned corners, because it's just doing stand-up every night. All of a sudden on Monday, you are a way better comedian than you were last Wednesday, and you don't know which set it was that made you realize like, oh yeah, if I do this, that works. Or I can say this and get away with it and it's funny. I can't say that and get away with it. So my best advice for comedians going through this right now, because I hope we're at the tail end of it, but I also don't know, would be try to find a way to scratch that itch without being able to do stand-up. If you can do that via Zoom shows or, you know, online shows, I would say do that. I don't necessarily like them, but I'm lucky enough that I can wait for audiences to come back. But I would also say you don't have to release everything you do. I think we're in this weird age where everyone wants to show you how busy they are without actually concentrating on making something that's really good. So, you know, before Big J and I got The Bonfire, we were going to do it as a podcast, and we did 10 episodes that we never released. They're just 10 hours of Jay and I sitting in my living room trying stuff. You know, the first 3 hours were us sitting down and the energy was real low. And then I had music, and then we made an agreement to stand up during the entire time. And then that became like, we kind of shifted with the energy. And then by the time we were able to have the opportunity to do the bonfire on Sirius XM, we kind of already knew what our dynamic was. And I think with the reason I'm saying this is like comedians, you can go and talk like this. Like I could talk to my computer and then I could watch it and you can watch it and be like, oh, that's funny. Or you could do a podcast and just do 10 episodes by yourself or find a theme and work it out. It's like, there's a lot to be said about working something out.
For sure. And just that repetition. And like you, talk about working something out for your special, your newest one. Like you not only worked out here in America, but then you went to like Ireland and then you went to like Scotland. Like you wanted to make sure this thing was airtight from every single angle to work it out.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that people who get sunburnt easily loved that hour. That was the whole point of that tour. It was just like, let me go to the whitest, freckliest places on earth and work these jokes. No, I was was really lucky to be able to do the Fringe Festival, which unfortunately isn't happening this year because of COVID. But it was a great opportunity, like you said, for repetition. And it felt, as someone that played high school football, I wasn't good at it, but I always loved football. It felt like going to a football camp where it was like, oh, I have part of the day to do Edinburgh stuff, walk around, get a coffee, hang out with Sean Patton. Well, I was really lucky to live with him and Jeffrey Baldinger and Caitlin Cook. And it was like a good house to live in because it's three other people doing shows, but also just three people that I got to live with and know better. But it was the best thing possible. Anyone that's doing an hour, whether it be an album or a special, I can't recommend doing the Fringe Festival more because it's just you go through an entire process of learning, failing, rebuilding, leaving strong. Michelle Wolf told me while I was there, she's like, when you get back to America, you're going to feel like a fucking super, like you have superpowers because you've just been doing it every night for an hour. And the first show I did back was like was the Kevin Barnett benefit at Brooklyn Steel. And it just felt like, oh, I'll just, they were like, do 8 minutes. And I was like, cool, I have this chunk. And I just like took it out of the hour and was like, damn, this thing is tight. Like you don't realize how tight the bit is until you do it. And, you know, it was a benefit show with a stacked lineup, but it was people doing like, hey, what's this guy doing? You know? And I came like, tick, 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 and just had it all like this fucking line into this line and knew when to let it breathe and shit. And, that was all Fringe Festival. So yeah, I think with the last hour, it was all about repetition and we agreed to do the special in December of 2018. And then I filmed it October of 2019, telling HBO, like, hey, give me 10 months to go. I had the hour. I mean, I would probably say what came out on the special was 45% when I sold it, what they saw originally. Wow. Uh-huh. And I had, you know, I have other bits that hopefully work when I go back on the road. I don't know. I don't even know if I know how to do fucking jokes anymore. But
I've thought
it was,
that too.
I've had dreams about it, man. I've been having dreams where I'm on stage and I don't know how to finish bits, where I'm like, carpenters, huh? It's like, guy could be Jesus, and then he's like non-union. But it's a thing where I miss the repetition. I miss the, you know, I was watching my girlfriend play with our dog yesterday at like 6:45, and I told her this morning, I was like, that's going to be weird when I'm like, at the bonfire at 6:45, and then I have to be like, oh, I got a 8:45 at the stand and a 9:35 at the cellar. And during this whole time, it was like me living at home, just being like, what should we have for dinner tonight, mother? You know,
when it comes to actually generating material, because that is something I think comics are, even if we're writing right now, it's like, who knows when I'm going to get on stage? Who knows if I'm going to remember it? Who knows if I'm going to care back then? But something I've heard you say that really helped you is when you started trying to make yourself laugh instead of trying to make other people laugh. Could you kind of expand on that and maybe give advice for how comics can start to shift their mindset in that direction?
God damn, dude, you're nailing it. I just got out of a therapy session where we talked about all of this, and it was a thing of, you know, I have a desperate need to be liked. I think all comedians do. I think that's why we have to stand up on stage and ask for the affection of strangers. But I also think it comes in different shades. And I think some people like nagging an audience and pushing at them and being like, huh, fucking, but you still like me. Like, Shane Gillis is the best I've ever seen at that. Like, Shane Gillis is the best at being like, you guys are gay. And they're like, I love you, you know, but he's like doing it in like a warm older brother kind of way where he can like, he's giving you a noogie on your head. You know, he's like, come here, you piece of shit. And you're like, I love you. What do you want to talk about? And then there's guys like, you know, Big J has like this incredible just outside guy smoking a cigarette energy. You know, he has like a real like, crazy, what's going on, huh? And you're like, yeah. And then the next thing you know, you're explaining your ex-girlfriend's asshole to him.
Yeah.
And you're like, exactly. How did I get into this? And I think mine was like the way I was raised. I grew up really afraid of my mom because I think she was stressed out and just kind of, you know, I was a very fearful child. I was alone. I was the only child, and my mom was working all the time, so I was alone. And then when she would bring in was like fear of, whether it be disappointment or you fucked up or you didn't do these right. So I think my first fucking 10 years of comedy was just me being like, hey, we're cool, right? Everything's cool. And then the last 5 years has been an eventual evolution of me trying to be like, oh, yeah, my sense of humor is why I'm here. Like me, the jokes I make in my head, I've said them out loud enough and I've paid enough taxes to know that that's a viable career. Now the question is like, am I doing jokes that I would want to watch? And that's a real hard question, because I don't like the HBO special. I think I put so much work into it. I was proud of it as a body of work, and I was really proud. That's the most proud of anything I've ever done. That's like, I almost get this like weird offense when people are like, hey, check out his Netflix half hour. I'm like, don't do that. That was a half-baked piece of shit. That was me trying to recoup for putting out an hour on Comedy Central that didn't go the way I wanted it to. But this HBO special is really the first thing that I've watched. You know, when I was editing it, I'd never watched it after I edited it. But where I watched it, I'm like, yeah, these bits are completed. Like they're completed. That's something I have to thank Fringe for. I went all the way through the bit, and when you go all the way through it, and it's like, a great book that people should read, if comedians should read, that helps with comedy, I think, and I'm about to reread it, is How to Win an Argument by Cicero. It's this book that I found, you know, in a bookstore, being a pretentious dickwad, but I found this book and I was like, oh, this is. He was a lawyer who had to not only represent his friends, but his enemies. And he's like one of the greatest arguers. I don't even know if that's a word, but he's like one of the greatest shit talkers of all time. And he lays it out. It's a very short read, but it's something that really, I read it before I did Fringe, and it made me, I kept thinking about this during the Fringe Festival, which was like, when you have an idea, cast a very wide net, so that when you pull it back, you've gone through everything. So when you have an idea, like cast the widest net possible to see what you can catch in it. And then when you pull it all back in, you'll know you went everywhere with the idea. So where you settle will be the best idea. I think he says it better than that, and the idea might be a little different. But point being is like, with a premise, I want to start working on like, I always loved watching guys like Kurt Metzger. Because Kurt Metzger was a guy where I'm like, man, that angle on that joke is unique and perfect in a way that no one else is going to do that angle. Nate Bargatze's unbelievable at that. Nate Bargatze's unbelievable at finding those in things that are just as simple as like grape jelly. You know, if I say like grape jelly, like I've had several conversations on the phone with Nate where in conversation he said something, whether it be about buying a tiger or whether it being about having ketchup in your refrigerator. At the time it was grape jelly and he changed it to ketchup. But then I'll watch his stand-up and be like, my God, he's got four different angles on that that maybe we didn't have in the conversation, but that he's built into this that are just genius. It's just so funny. And I really love that about All My Friends. You know, a guy like Vecchione who can do a Megabus bit, where if I told you there's a Megabus bit, you'd be like, I don't know if I could listen to 15 minutes of that. But then you see Vecchione's and it's layered and it's nuanced and it's really funny. And I always really love those kind of jokes.
Well, this actually ties into our first question when we're talking about joke writing, because, I mean, you being able to tackle dark humor in the way you do and the topics you do is, I mean, inspiring to all of us comics and showing what's possible within comedy writing. And Christian Williams, actually, he actually messaged me this morning saying how excited he was about this. So he actually got here early and posted the first question. So
fuck it, dude. Thanks, Christian.
So his question, he says, crackle, crackle, Dan.
Yeah, goddamn right.
Says, how do you find ways to turn difficult personal matters into good comedy, like your joke and material about your dad?
Ah, man. Well, that's like something that Jay and I have talked about on The Bonfire before, is like styles of comedy where new comics try to be like a Doug Stanhope. And you're like, you can't be Doug Stanhope. Doug Stanhope is one of the greatest of all time and built that naturally. Bill Hicks was Bill Hicks, and that's it. Like, you're not going to walk in and be one of these guys. It's like trying to, you know, I look at it as like fixing an engine, and it's like you got to learn how to build simpler engines before you get to a highly complex one. Like, you can't just walk in and build, a six-cylinder where you're like, I know exactly how this runs. You got to build a little fucking go-kart engine, and then a dirt, you know, you got to learn as you build up. And I wish I could have started comedy with that joke about my dead dad, but it took me, you know, 15 years to find out, okay, what's the angle where it's, I can show everyone that I think the situation is funny, because I'm noticing the people that get offended when I first started doing it were people that had no skin in the game. It was people that had both living parents, and they were kind of like, oh God, that's kind of sad. And you're like, well, why? Why is it sad? Your parents not dead. My parents dead. Like, I'm talking about my thing. And really, I just wanted to get to make fun of my dad for being a Jimmy Buffett fan. That was really like that, because that was something where it was like, I didn't realize my dad was a hack alcoholic until The Bonfire. And Big J was like, dude, yeah, like Jimmy Buffett fans. He's like, that's funny. And I was like, it is really funny. And he loved Jimmy Buffett. And it's like sincere. Just like finding out that I was a bar kid. And that's like a bad thing. It's like, I don't think, point being is like with dark humor, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, what you find funny about it. And then it's like how you find something funny and how other people can come to it and understand that you find it funny. So it's not a big deal, I guess, is my way of saying that. Like, getting into dark humor is, first off, it's the genuine reaction I have to anything sad in my life is to immediately mock it. Almost every time something bad has happened to me in my life, I think I've gone to humor as just being like, well, this fucking sucks. Because I've never understood the people that wail in it. You know, there'll be time for the pain, but some people react different and some people want to be sad and wail in it. And those people write songs and write plays. You know, I think comics are the ones that are like, man, fuck this shit. Mm-hmm. This fucking sucks.
So is that where that bit started, when you're like, well, I had to find out what was funny to me first. So were you like, I think it's funny he was a Jimmy Buffett fan. Now let me find all the different angles into it.
Exactly. My initial premise was like, my dad was a Jimmy Buffett fan, and that's hilarious that he died of alcoholism. Like, my initial premise was like, my dad got what he wanted. Like, Jimmy Buffett fans want to drink themselves to death. My dad did it. So, like, that's a good thing. Like, I really like taking negative things and trying to do, put them in a positive light in a funny way. Not in a serious way where I'm like, this negative thing's pretty good, in a funny way where you're like, what if this was good? Like, what if this was a good thing? Like, that would be, you know, really funny, I think. Because whenever I see stuff, whether it be from the past or something that's like completely wrong and in the wrong light, I always think that's the funniest, where I'm like, how did they think this was a good take? like they thought this was right. And I think with jokes, that's kind of what I like. That's how I like to find my angles, is like, okay, well, what would be the flip side? How would I find this to be funny?
Oh, so it's like, this is bad, but what if it wasn't? And you start to build from that.
Yeah, man, I grew up with a mom that was like, don't be a pussy. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up with a mom that was like, you're hurt? Okay, fucking get up. I mean, this woman survived like 2 major car accidents, Guillain-Barré. Like, she was like, I don't give a fuck that you're sad. Now, granted, that royally fucked me on a lot of other issues in life. But as far as a comedian, it's like, she put me on the wheel in Conan. Like, she was just like, push the fucking wheel. And then by the time I got off it, I was sitting there. My mom is like, Daniel, what is best in life? I'm like, to make fun of everything that hurts, to turn it into punchlines, to destroy your enemies. I mean, that was like when my mom basically, she put me on the wheel, dude.
Only a comedian is like, all that emotional abuse prepared me to be a great comic. Yes.
I mean, yo, man, there was a reason that they let men fuck children in Sparta. Because it made them into good soldiers. They were like, I love this man. He took care of me. It's like fucked up when you read like Spartan history, because we glorify like Sparta as like, they were the greatest warriors. It's like, dude, they raped kids in order to fucking establish a connection. You're like, it's fucked up. But it's also, that to me is the kind of thing where I think that's funny, where I'm like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that we allowed such an atrocity for something that, like, oh, it's cool. They were such good warriors. It's like, you know how much dirt they did to get there?
Yeah, but they had nice abs.
Exactly, dude. If you're going to wear a cape, you're going to end up raping some kids. You know? That's just how it is. Shirtless cape.
All right, let's get the next one in here. See how we can segue off of raping kids.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, dude. Let's come off Spartan butt rape and go into something fun.
So this comes from Chase Bonin here. He says, it seems you and a lot of your friends are getting a lot of recognition, like Joe List, Mark Norman, Sean Patton. Are there any other comics you recommend we follow that are on your level but may have not had the exposure? And do you float ideas around with other comics when writing?
Yeah, all the time, man. All the time. Mike Vecchione is one of the, I mean, he's my roommate, and he's a guy who's been on here that I float. I'm living with my girlfriend now, and we're making the step towards both of us are going to split up. You know, Vecchione and I have lived together for fucking 8 or 9 years, and he was the go-to. He was the go-to of like, hey, has anyone done this bit? And then you're like, yeah, so-and-so has a bit that's kind of similar. And then you're like, all right, let me drop the premise. But, you know, Michelle Wolf and Nate and Shane Gillis are probably the people I call the most with, like, hey, does anyone do this? Or is like, is this funny? You just need that one. You just need that one sentence where you're like, hey, is this sentence funny? And then they're like, yeah. And then you have to be like a little truffle pig and fucking dig into that sentence and be like, how deep does this go? And I think I'm very lucky because the people that I am friends with are some of the best in comedy, talent-wise. Mm-hmm. I think it's all my friends are top tier. And, you know, Sean Patton would be the name that I would say check him out, because I think he is criminally underrated. Agreed. I think he's criminally underrated. I think Chloe Hilliard is really fucking funny, and I think people should check her out. I'm trying to think of who else. Is, you know, Norman and List, watching them blow up, those are guys Dan St. Germain. Dan St. Germain's a guy where I'm like, he's so goddamn funny. I watch like a minute of him and I'm like, he's the beard and the hair, but it's more than that. It's the way that Dan was a guy when we came up together. When I would watch him, I would get jealous of those jokes. Like, I remember I watched him at South by Southwest do this. He's like, there's Papa John's pizza, but there's never Step Papa John's pizza. You know, like, it's like the pizza's not as good. And he's like, hey, man, I know we don't get along, but I love your mom. And I'm like, dude, I remember watching that and being like, dude, he's so goddamn funny. But there's a ton of comics out there. And I think this is a great time for comedy, even though it's shut down, because there's so many avenues where people can explore and learn about comedians.
Great. Yeah, a lot of good. Yeah, there's so much comedy right now. And I remember Dan St. Germain's one of those guys who like he writes on a lot of shows and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So it's like it's kind of like in Ian Edwards, who we've had on here. It's like he's great. Super funny, but he's been in that writing world that can kind of conflict with getting that stand-up exposure.
Absolutely. One of the funniest people I think that I've ever seen in my life, Luke Cunningham, was a great stand-up comedian and started writing and then walked away from stand-up. I don't know if it was a good or bad thing, but he was a guy where I would watch him do stand-up and then he'd be like, yeah, I can't really do it that much. I got to go write. And I'm like, God damn it, dude. Your stand-up is so fucking funny. And yeah, it's just there's people like that. There's just people that comedy is a business, and a part of this business is traveling. And if you're going to do stand up, you have to be willing to be gone Thursday through Sunday most of your life, living in a hotel room. But if you love comedy enough and you have a video game system and some decent weed, not a bad weekend.
Oh, you're a beacon of inspiration for all of us, Dan.
Yeah, it's smoke weed, play video games.
And the next one is from Lee Hudson, who's actually, he's from across the pond, actually. So
yeah, I feel like I've met Lee before.
Maybe,
that name sounds familiar. I don't know, man. Again, I smoke weed and play video games, so it could have been a fucking created character or something. I don't know.
But we have comics all over the world that tune into this. So he asks, what is it like working with Chris Storr to shoot your special?
Oh man, he was great. Chris Storr fucking nailed it. I think I'm in this weird part of my life where I'm learning how to speak up for what I want creatively, which I think is a weird time because it's kind of like a. You know, I think in general, white guys need to do less public squawking and do more listening. But then, like, creatively, it's weird because it's like, oh, yeah, I've learned that if I don't say what I want, the thing that I'm going to make isn't going to be what I want. And that's a hard thing, is to go through the process of making something and being like, I would have done it a little bit different. I loved the way that my hour special for Comedy Central, Not Special, was filmed. Marcus LeBoy, fucking up his last name, Marcus, and the guys there did a great job shooting it. Chris Storer came in and I had to have a conversation with him where I was like, this is exactly what I want. I want lo-fi, no audience. I want an old school feel to a stand-up special. I felt like everyone now was doing shiny and bright and like big words and neon, and you're like, fucking, this is stand up. Look how big this fucking stage is. Oh my God, you can't cover it in an hour. And I wanted to do something that was like, yeah, man, here's me in the pocket, just fucking firing jokes off. And here's an hour of like, I didn't want one moment of fat. I wanted it cut. I wanted it in there. And I told Chris, I was like, I want you to film it in a specific way. And he said, yes. And I believed him. And then when we did Tech Scout and all that shit, and I showed up the day of the special and he showed me what the cameras looked like, I was like, fucking A, dude, you did it. You did the exact thing I wanted. You know, and he was like, and it's great to be like, to have surprises where they did a shot in the special where it was my back. So it's the spotlight and then my back. And then you can barely see the audience around it. But I loved that shot. And that wasn't something I asked for. That was just something that he did. And Chris is a guy that he understands what the fuck you're trying to get. And so he was really super easy to work with because it was a thing of like, oh man, you're hearing what I'm saying. And that makes me think this is going to come out the way it did. And then when I watched the first cut, watching a cut of a special is really fucking difficult because you can't, I've learned when editing a special, listen to it first, then watch it. Because if you're trying to listen and watch, you're going to get lost in like hand movements and shit like that. And I listened to the HBO special and I was like, yeah, that's what I wanted. That's the hour. And then I watched it and I was so pleasantly surprised of like, oh shit, man, this guy fucking did it. This guy made this into the thing I wanted to.
Well, let's take you off your high horse here, and let's take you back to your worst bomb. This is kind of like a combo question. Matias Siegel and John Russos, both are asking bombing questions. But let's go with one is like, do you remember the first time you bombed? But maybe like maybe your biggest bomb and how it felt.
Well, first, just because I know off the top of my head, the first like real bad bomb that I had was at an open mic at Laughs in Tucson. And it was a 3-minute spot. And I went up there and I hadn't really gotten into writing out sets. I kind of had ideas and was like, when I get up there, I'll just fall through the idea. Also, Marcus Raboy, I just remembered his name. And I feel like a dickhead because he directed my... I remember going on stage. I remember exactly what I was wearing. I remember premises that went nowhere, and then I would bail and go to another premise that went nowhere. So it'd be like, you guys ever go to the grocery store and you're like, I was trying to go on a date, and this girl, and it was like that, dude. It was a 3-minute set. It's one of the only times in my life I've ever bailed. It's one of my only times in my life I've ever bailed from the stage, and I got off at a minute and a half, and it was fucking brutal, dude. I went to the back of that comedy club, and this is when you could still smoke cigarettes inside, and I smoked a half a pack of cigarettes with my head in between my legs. Like, I was just like smoking, just like, oh my God, that sucked so fucking bad. And then probably the biggest bomb that I've had is, I don't know, man, I've bombed a lot at Caroline's. I've had a couple hot ones. Yeah, dude, I took two tough ones back to back on New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve is a rough night for stand up. Every comic knows that. When you do Caroline's New Year's Eve, you're in Times Square, and part of the sell of the ticket to the comedy show, because it's not a major headliner. It's like Caroline's used to do it, where it's like five really good New York stand up comics. So you get like five like up and coming guys. Or girls, or whoever, and you would do the shows, and then the appeal was at 11:45 or 11:50, you go upstairs and you get to watch the ball drop, and then you get to go right back inside and have drinks and celebrate the new year. I did it the first time. I did it. I was drinking, and it was like I was like second on the show, and it was fun, and I was like fucking hammered. It was Joe DeRosa was on the shows with me, and we were fucking drinking and smoking cigarettes, and in the green room, and it was just a fucking party. Second time I did it, I had my girlfriend with me. I was sober for a year, and it was New Year's Eve, and they had me go last on both shows. First show, they just don't care. They're just there to do it. I use the bit every New Year's, but it's still true. And it was birthed from that, where I was like, how the fuck are y'all judging me when you're wearing plastic top hats? You're like wearing a fake fancy thing, and you think I'm not funny? Fuck you. That was like my first reaction. The second show was, to this day, I can remember the feeling of that bomb of like, usually when you're bombing, you can get a joke and it's like, oh, there we go. I'm up out of it. This one was like, oh no. Oh no. Oh no. It was like falling downstairs where I was like, that joke didn't work. That joke didn't work. And then I start getting peanut butter mouth and then I start sweating. And then I'm like, that joke didn't work. That joke didn't work. And then I get to the end. I'm doing 15 minutes. It's only a 15 minute bomb. And by fucking minute 12, losing the audience hurts more than anything. When you've completely lost the audience and they start talking to themselves, because then it's a subconscious effort from the audience to be like, I don't want to listen to this fucking idiot anymore. I'd rather talk to you. And so I remember losing them. And then I remember all of them starting to look at their watch and being like, it's 11:50. It's 11:50. They're like, look at their phones and be like, it's 11:50. We got to get. And then like people started to get up and walk to go. Oh, dude. finishing your closing bit while half the room is leaving is one of the most humbling experiences anyone can go through. When you're like, and then I say to him, because you have like that line locked up, you know,
right.
Like, I go over there and I look at him and I say, that's not a parachute. And people are just walking out and like, thank you, everyone. Good night. Fuck. And then you got to walk up stairs and celebrate New Year's with these people that just watched you fail. Fuck that. That was probably one of the worst bombs. Because I remember my girlfriend being like, she was very like, you know, one of those girls that's like, baby, it's New Year's. And I was kind of like, oh, God damn it. That was like grating on me because I was like, you just watched me eat shit. How are you this happy? How are you not like, hey, dude, do you need a cigarette? Like, how are you not like, you want to sit down? If I were my girlfriend in that time when I bombed, I would have had an ice pack for the back of my neck.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the end of a New Japan pro wrestling match, like where they just put ice on them. Like, you took a lot of bumps in there and you're like, I know. Fucking hurt.
How are you able to? I feel like I've been doing comedy 10 years now, and like I'm getting better at bouncing back from bombs. But I mean, you know, they still suck. Like, how have you been able to kind of alleviate the repercussions of a bomb and kind of make it less like daunting?
I don't know, man. I think another set is the only cure.
Yeah,
it's the only cure for a bomb.
Yeah,
it's the only thing that can pull you out is like a good set. Because then you're like, okay, so those people were wrong. Because that's what you walk away from. You're like, was I wrong? Am I wrong to be in this? And then you have a good set, and you're like, oh, no, never mind. They were wrong. Fuck them. These guys are right. This audience gets it. Those other fucking dolts didn't understand what I was saying. Yeah, so it's, there is no way. And I think, honestly, it is bombing is the soreness in comedic exercise. It's like if you're really sore, then you need to work out more. You need to be up there more. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's always gonna be a soreness with it, because you're like, man, I've had mornings where I've woken up and I've been like, God damn it, that last show. Like, I'll do three shows at the Stand. In the first two, I'll be like, looks like I found what I was born on this earth to do. And then the third show, I'll be like, hey, should I kill myself by eating my own shit? Because that last crowd couldn't have cared less.
Well, it's good. We're not alone in that feeling.
Nah, man, bomb. But it's also a necessity. It's like, it's a part of the process. I'm going to, dude, coming back. I'm in St. Louis, June 25th through the 27th. That first show, there are going to be some misses. There are going to be some. It might not even be the first show. It might be like Friday late show where I'm like, what the fuck am I doing on stage?
Well, let's get to Leo here, because this is a good one from the perspective of even like taking your comment to the next level. He asks, Leo Konopka, he's asking, is there more benefit from starting my own mics in Baltimore, like starting shows, or should he move to like one of the big hubs? He's like, he's starting shows, he's hosting, he's the door guy at a place, but what's...
Move to a big place.
Okay.
My advice for anyone would be get a year or two under your belt to kind of understand how comedy feels in whatever city you start in or whatever city you live in. Spend about a year learning the, you know, low stakes, man. Go do open mics that are stressful as fuck to you. But when you look back 15 years later, you're going to be like, oh, that wasn't shit. So go do those. Like, it's, you know, at the beginning of every video game where you have the really first easy level and it's just kind of there to teach you the controls of the game. That's what your local scene is. Go do that level and run through it once or twice, and then move the difficulty to hard and move to a hub, move to New York or LA or Chicago or a city where you're going to be around people that scare you and make you feel wrong that you're doing this, but also there's a weird inspiration of like, I'll catch up to you guys. I'll make it. I'll get to where you guys are at, because that's something that I couldn't have, you know, just pure idiot luck going from Tucson, where it's 2 years of you know, I had Laughs, which was a real club, but then there was Casinos, where I was just bombing all the time, opening for people in casinos, to small weird shows that weren't really around, I think around much more now, but then moving to New York at still a beginner's level, where I, you know, I know a lot of guys that are headliners that moved to New York, and they're like, I'm not getting spots. And it's like, yeah, because you were up here in your city, and now you're down here in this city. So if you're rising up in your city, it's easier to come down a little to go back up, you know, like take a step back to go take five steps back to go fucking a million steps forward. And I think it's really daunting to move to a big city, but be comfortable with the, I was comfortable with the idea of like, I'm going to be a waiter for however long it takes for me to get to become a stand-up comedian. And then the uncomfortable part of that wasn't the beginning. It was when I was starting to get sets, and when I was starting to get, you know, I got on Live at Gotham on Comedy Central, and I was like starting to open for like Bobby Kelly and other people like that. And it was like, oh, I don't want to be a waiter anymore. I just want to be a comedian. But that was the difficult part, because you're like, but I could see the light. I could be like, I'm getting stuff. And there was really depressing mornings where I was going in and setting up a cafe at a Mexican restaurant and being like, dude, I fucking killed it last night at Stand Up New York. And now I'm going to be the, you know, these people's fucking iced tea bitch for the next 7 hours. And it's like, fuck this, man. Fuck this. Like Colin Quinn said, I had a good set, and now I got to listen to a stockbroker tell me that the margarita tastes weird. It's like, fuck you, it tastes weird. You ordered the wrong tequila. So it was like a thing. That's my advice for moving to a big city. As far as starting a shows, I don't recommend starting shows, because I've seen a lot of good comedians get trapped into spot trading, where they're good enough to be on a show, but because they have their show, whoever runs the show that they were going to be on now wants to be on their show. So now you don't know, am I being booked because I'm funny, or am I being booked because I have something to give this comedian? And I think that's a dangerous spot to be in.
And you moved to New York being at like the Mecca. And when we had Nate on here, he talked about coming up in New York, and he had like funny, yeah, like Patrice O'Neill and like Bill Burr's story. Do you have any just unforgettable story being around like a comedian like one of those two that you just never forget?
Man, I can't describe to you the feeling of like growing up, and I know a lot of comics will immediately feel this, but it's like growing up such a big comedy fan and like loving stand-up comedy enough that you want to get into it. And then you start, it's seeing people come off the TV screen. It's like people crawling out of the TV. The first time I saw Chris Rock walk into Stand Up New York to do a spot, I was like, oh my God, it's like seeing one of the gods. Mm-hmm. You're just seeing one of the gods walk by you. And my holy shit moment, my first holy shit moment of like, man, I'm in New York and I'm doing stand up was, I'm obsessed with the movie Comedian. I'll probably watch it again this weekend just because I brought it up, but the documentary is my favorite thing. And I don't even think Jerry's not my favorite part of the documentary. It's Colin Quinn. And the way Colin talks about comedy is something that I've always romanticized. And I think he's one of the greatest of all time. And I became friends with Joe List, and he was like, let's go to the Cellar and have some beers. And I was like, yeah, all right. And I was nervous as fuck. And we went into the Cellar and never went around the table. I just sat at the bar. Joe List and I were drinking. We each had our own pitcher of beer.
Perfect.
I remember that clearly.
Oh,
we're,
yeah,
both alcoholics.
Yep.
So we each had our own pitcher of beer, and Colin was fat. Colin was like overweight. And Colin was wearing a red hoodie and like a red sweatpants or whatever. And he comes over and he puts his arm around both of us at the bar. And he goes, did you guys see that bomb? And Joe List is like, no, I didn't. We were up here. And he goes, I don't know what it is about athletic wear, but you always wear it when you're the least in shape. And he was just like being Colin Quinn. And I'm just like dumbstruck. I'm just like sitting there like, oh, this is great. And then Joe List goes, Colin, this is my friend Dan Soder. He just moved here from Colorado to be a comedian. And Colin goes, what's your last name? I go, Soder. He goes, ugh, change it. And then he walked away. And I just remember being like, man, Colin Quinn just ughed me. Which, growing up listening to Opie and Anthony and being a big fan of Patrice and Burr and Colin and those guys and Jim Norton, it was like, oh, man, like becoming – being able to text Jim Norton to me is fucking insane. It's fucking insane to be like, oh, if I need to reach out, I can just text Jim Norton. Just like, hey, Bobby Kelly being like an older brother to me. When the quarantine first started, my girlfriend and I were rewatching The Wire. And we got bored one night and she was like, yeah, I'm going to read. I don't want to watch TV. And I went and watched Tourgasm. I like went and watched it because I remember when it came out. And now it's so weird to know Bobby as well as I know him. And to see that, and you're like, I remember when that came out, and like, you know, Goldman and Bobby were like these guys that you just didn't walk up and talk to them. And now I can like call Bobby, and Bobby will be like, why don't you fucking call me earlier, dude?
So rewarding.
It's also in the same sense, it's been fucking awesome watching my friends become big. Like, it's been great watching Nate go into theaters and become like one of the best working stand-up comedians. It's been great watching Michelle Wolf just become this undeniable beast of a comedian, you know, and just being like, oh man, all my friends like are really good. Michael Che, like watching him become like even bigger. Like we started the show talking about that show, but the fact that Che can just, without really a lot of social media, just put it out there like, yo man, I want to do a show. And then like 1,000 people show up outside. It's like, man, that's so great. And just knowing that how funny he is and how funny Michelle and Nate are, it's just cool watching it start to pay off.
Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time here, Dan. This has been great.
Yeah, man. I love talking comedy, so I really appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Yeah, and all of those people you named, they are more than likely and open to coming on this show. Please, if you want to text Jim Norton right now or you want to call Michelle Wolf.
That, I don't know if I have that warm of a relationship with Jim where I feel like, you want to do this podcast? He'd be like, fuck. Even Wolf, who's one of my best friends, I would be like, you want to do this podcast? And she's like, how do you know him? What do you owe him?
Like, oh. What do you owe him? Did he know you when you were a drunk?
Yeah. Did you say the wrong thing around him? And you're like, I don't know. I don't fucking know, Michelle.
Oh, it's hilarious. Yeah, all those people are definitely like, we're trying to do something positive, you know, we're trying to make comedy more accessible, but also creating more like respect around the craft and getting to interview people like you. I think comedians learn a lot, but I think comedy fans also create a new appreciation for just what goes into not only the art, but the lifestyle. Like you said, you've really got to want it. And a lot of people don't understand that. And doing interviews like this, I think, help people to create more appreciation around comedy.
I appreciate you having interviews like that because comedy is something that I fucking love, and it's something that I've greatly missed, and it's something that I'm glad is slowly starting to return. And comedians are the best people on earth. I think they're incredibly powerfully fragile and wonderfully broken, and I think that's like the best way to put it is like powerfully fragile and wonderfully broken. It's like all my friends are, man, if I worked at an office with them, I'd have a real problem with them. But being comedians with them makes me love them more than anyone on earth.
And we always like to end this show like with your closing advice for comics, whether it's a favorite tip you've picked up along the journey or just something you've learned along your way. Do you have any like closing advice or insight for comedians out there?
Yeah, understand, this is specifically for comedians, is understand that the people that work at those comedy clubs might not be the biggest comedy fans, but they're the most important, because just as easily as without us, they're just a room with tables and booze. Without them, we're just crazy people yelling under a bridge. So be decent to every venue manager, even if they're a dick, just be decent to them, unless they're like fucking, you know, like sexist or trying to rape you or being racist or some shit, like then fuck them. But I'm saying, know that like most of the servers there, this wasn't their first option to work at a fucking funny bone. You know what I mean? There's some people that are, but there's a lot of people that are like, I got hired at the Funny Bone. I'm kind of a fan of stand-up. Be cool to them, because you might make their shitty Friday night better if you're a little nice to them and then they find you funny. Then they're not waiting tables. They're listening to you headline twice And I always like that. I always like when waiters are like, dude, thanks for this weekend. It was like fun to work during this weekend. And you're like, ah, fuck yes, man. That's it. That's all we are, is just the fucking lube. So just, you know, lube them up, baby.
Yeah, be nice. Tip them as well. Don't forget to tip them.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
Tip them. Take care of them.
Yes.
And they'll take care of you.
They're co-worker. Like, you're all co-workers. A lot of people overlook that, but you're all a co-worker at this establishment. Be a good co-worker to them.
That's probably the most succinct way I could that can be said. You work with these people. Mm. Be decent. Be decent to be around. You're not that much more special than them. Just a couple things broke right for you, and that's why you're on that side of it.
So is there anything you want to promote, or how can people follow you? Want to encap it with that?
I got. I just found out, we haven't made the official announcement, but we're going to put out the HBO special Son of a Gary as an album in a couple weeks. Ooh. So if you haven't heard it, be on the lookout for that. That hour is coming out. There's also the full hour of Not Special is on YouTube. You can go watch that. And also listen to The Bonfire Monday through Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern on Comedy Central Radio, Sirius XM. It's a lot of fun. And if you can't pay for the subscription, get it elsewhere. You know what I mean? Get it elsewhere.
Awesome. Well, Hop Breathiverse, Dan Soder. Give it up for Dan Soder here. Wow.
Oh, listen to that.
That was
incredible. That's the first clap I've gotten in months, man. That felt good.
All right, Hop Breathiverse, go forth with your days. Go join our Facebook group to get involved in more of these Q&As, and we will see you next time on Hot Breath. 100 breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.